Bill uses all the way through the book examples to teach us what he wants us to know. Mm-hmm. And throughout the rest of this chapter, we're going to look at some examples. And each example will talk about the state of the mind just before we take the first drink. Can we see the truth or can we not? The first example is over on page 32. Second paragraph. A man of 30 was doing a great deal of spree drinking. He was very nervous in the morning after these bouts and quieted himself with more liquor. He was ambitious to succeed in business, but saw that he would get nowhere if he drank at all. Once he started, he had no control whatever. He made up his mind until he'd been successful in business and retired, he would not touch another drop. An exceptional man, he remained bone dry for 25 years and retired at the age of 55 after a successful and happy business career. Then he fell victim to a belief, which practically every alcoholic has, that his long period of sobriety and self-discipline had qualified him to drink as other men. Out came his carpet slippers and a bottle. In 2 months, he was in the hospital, puzzled and humiliated. He tried to regulate his drinking for a while, making several trips to the hospital meantime. Then, gathering all his forces, he attempted to stop altogether and found he could not. Every means of solving his problem which money could buy was at his disposal. Every attempt failed. Though a robust man at retirement, he went to pieces quickly and was dead within 4 years. Now, this case contains a powerful lesson. Most of us have believed that if we remain sober for a long stretch, we could thereafter drink normally. But here is a man who at 55 years found he was just where he had left off at 30. We've seen the truth demonstrated again and again. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Commencing to drink after a period of sobriety, we're in a short time as bad as ever. If we're planning to stop drinking, there must be no reservation of any kind, nor any lurking notion that someday we'll be immune to alcohol. Now, the truth is this. The truth is that once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. We've never seen one single case where one of us has ever been able to go back to successful drinking. Now, if you believe anything other than the truth, you believe a lie. The lie that this guy believed is, after 25 years of sobriety, he now would be able to drink like other people. Now, based on that lie, he took a drink. The drink triggered the allergy. He ended up, in a short period of time, dying from alcoholism. You know, there's something odd about the truth. The truth is the truth, and it's always there. Never changes. And if you believe anything other than the truth and act upon the lie, sooner or later you're going to run into that truth, and the truth's going to beat your brains out. In this particular case, he died from alcoholism because he believed a lie. He had a form of insanity. He had an obsession of the mind. He had an illusion. He had deluded himself into believing something that isn't true. Now, is this guy's real problem the fact that he's allergic to alcohol, or that he has a form of insanity that tells him it's okay to drink alcohol? The real problem of the alcoholic centers in the mind rather than the body. All action is born in thought. I can't drink without thinking about drinking. And I can't drink on the truth. I have to believe that this time it's going to be different. This time I've found a group of people I can drink with and they won't get drunk. This time, always leads me to believe something that isn't true. I fall for the illusion, the delusion. I become insane. I think I can drink. And I take a drink and then the allergy kills me. But my problem is not the allergy. My problem is the state of the mind prior to taking of the drink, the believing of the lie, a form of insanity. Let's look at another example. Let's go over to page 34, middle of the page. For those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. We're assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. Whether such a person can quit upon a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he's already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. Many of us felt that we had plenty of character. There was a tremendous urge to cease forever, yet we found it impossible. This is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it, this utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. How then should we help our readers determine their own satisfaction whether they are one of us? The experiment of quitting for a period of time will be helpful, but we think we can render an even greater service to alcoholic sufferers and perhaps to the medical fraternity. So we shall describe some of the mental states that precede a relapse in the drinking, for obviously this is the crux of the problem. Now remember, always, just before we drink, we're stone cold sober. Just before we drink, there's no alcohol in the system at all. What sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink? Friends who have reasoned with him after a spree which has brought him to the point of divorce or bankruptcy are mystified when he walks directly into a saloon. Why does he? Of what is he thinking? Our first example is a friend we shall call Jim. Now, Joe just loves old Jim. He gets a little screwed up with him once in a while. Let's see what he can do with Jim today. Joe?
Well, I just love this guy. I don't know why. Maybe he and I think a lot alike. He's my main man. Okay. Let's look at Jim. This man has a charming wife and family. He inherited a lucrative automobile agency. He has a commendable war record. He's a good salesman. Everybody likes him. Typical alcoholic, isn't he? He is an intelligent man, normal so far as we can see, except for a nervous disposition. He did no drinking until he was 35. In a few years, he became so violent when intoxicated, he had to be committed. On leaving the treatment center, he came into contact with us. I mean, they changed the name, but they, you know, it used to be asylums, now they're treatment centers. You know. Same thing, they got a different name on them. Okay, we told him what we knew about alcoholism, and what they know about alcoholism was step one. We're powerless of alcoholism and become unmanaged. They told him about the problem and the answer we had found. They told him about step two. The answer is step two. He made a beginning, and at the end of step three, in our book it says step three is the beginning, so it looked like Jim took three steps. You know, we see a lot of people today coming into AA, and they take three steps like Jim. And they say one, two, and three, and out the door, you know. AA is getting like baseball. One, two, three, and you're out, you know. His family reassembled. He began to work as a salesman for the business he had lost through drinking. All went well for a time, but he failed to enlarge on his spiritual life. Jim didn't take any more steps. He wouldn't do the action steps. He wouldn't do any more, and we see that happening. You know what happened? To his consternation, he found himself drunk half a dozen times in rapid succession. Jim got drunk six times real quick. On each occasion, we worked with him. These were good alcoholics in those days. Nowadays, they won't work with you six times. Jim, they'll say, go on. They won't even bother with you no more. But they tried to help with Jim each time he got drunk. We weren't careful of what had happened. He agreed he was a real alcoholic in a serious condition. He knew he faced another trip to the treatment center if he kept on. More, he would lose his family, whom he had deep affection. Yet he got drunk again. Now, this is seven times. These were good alcoholics, but they were getting a little fed up with Jim. You know, they said, wait a minute, Jim, this is seven times. Look, let's don't go through this no more. Let's kind of sit down and analyze and see how is this happening. Let's figure this out. So they said, this is his story. And he said, how did you get drunk? He said, I came to work on Tuesday morning. You know, I took many years before I saw this. You read a book and you see something you haven't seen. Every time you go over it, you see something new. You know, I came to work on Tuesday morning. Where was Jim Monday? You know. You know, we're bad about Mondays.
Old Bill had a sly sense of humor. If you look for it, you will find it in here once in a while. I can almost see him chuckling over this Tuesday morning deal. Now remember, insanity is the inability to see the truth. Insanity is where we go maybe from normal to abnormal thinking. Insanity is where we begin to believe the lie. Let's see when Jim becomes insane.
See, I remember I felt irritated. I had to be a salesman for a concern I once owned.
That's probably absolutely normal. I imagine everybody in here would be a little irritated if we had to be a salesman for a concern that we once owned. I don't think that's insanity. That's probably normal.
I had a few words with boss, but nothing serious.
Boss probably said, "Say, Jim, by the way, where were you all day yesterday?" Nothing real bad. Just enough to get us a little bit irritated.
Then I decided driving the country as he on my prospects for a car.
Probably perfectly normal. You want to get away from the shop a little bit. We've had a little run-in with the boss. We're going to get out of there. We're going to go out in the country, and we're going to go see a person we already know to sell a car to. That's probably normal thinking for an alcoholic car salesman.
On the way, I felt hungry, so I stopped at a roadside place where they had a bar. I had no intention of drinking. I just thought I'd get a sandwich.
What's more normal than if you're hungry to stop at a roadside place where you can get a sandwich? The fact that they have a bar is absolutely beside the point. We have no intention of drinking. Besides that, in that part of the country in those days, you probably couldn't find a roadside place that didn't have a bar. So we're going in there to get a sandwich, not to drink. Normal thinking for a hungry, alcoholic car salesman.
I also had a notion that I might find a customer for a car at this place, which was familiar, for I had been going there for years and eating there many times during the months I was sober.
We might find us a customer for a car in there. There's nothing new about us going to this place anyhow. We've been in there many times during the months that we're sober. We're just going to go in there and get us a sandwich and maybe sell a car while we're in there. Normal thinking for an alcoholic car salesman.
I sat down at the table and ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk.
What's more normal than to sit down at the table and order a sandwich and a glass of milk? Normal thinking for an alcoholic car salesman.
Still no thought of drinking, I ordered another sandwich and decided to have another glass of milk.
Nothing wrong with two sandwiches and two glasses of milk if you're hungry enough. If you're a member of Overeaters Anonymous, you may have a little problem there, but for an alcoholic car salesman, that's absolutely normal. Two sandwiches and two glasses of milk.
Okay.
Now then comes the squiggly writing.
Suddenly, the thought crossed my mind. If I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it wouldn't hurt me on a full stomach.
Now, that's absolute insanity for this alcoholic car salesman
to believe that.
To believe that he can take an ounce of whiskey and put it in milk and it wouldn't hurt him on a full stomach. This is where he became insane. This is where he believed the lie. Now, based on the lie, he makes a decision and takes some action.
I ordered a whiskey and poured it in the milk. I vaguely sensed I was not being any too smart, so felt assured that I was taking the whiskey on a full stomach.
Now we've got the whiskey inside ourselves. The phenomenon of craving begins to develop, and now then we can't stop drinking. Where do we go from here?
The experiment went so well, I ordered another whiskey and poured it into milk. That didn't bother me, so I tried another. Thus thought one more journey to the treatment center for Jim. There was threat, commitment, the loss of family, this to say nothing, intense mental and physical suffering with drinking always caused him. He had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic, yet all reason for not drinking were easily pushed aside in the face of foolish idea he could take whiskey if he mixed it with milk. Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. How can such a lack or proportion of ability to think straight be called anything else? And here we see a definition for insanity. Insanity is a lack of proportion of ability to think straight. Specifically in this case, at certain times we say the alcoholic on our own we do not have the ability to think straight about alcohol. In all other areas, we may think straight. But when it comes to alcohol, we are insane.
Now, is this guy's real problem the fact that he's allergic to alcohol? Or that he has an obsession of the mind that leads him to believe that he can drink alcohol when it's obvious he can't? The real problem of the alcoholic centers in the mind rather than in the body. You know, I have a good friend here today who happens to be an alcoholic car salesman. I never read this story but what I don't think about John. John, where are you anyhow? You still in
there? There he is.
There he is, way back in the back. Bottom of page 37. Our behavior is as absurd and incomprehensible with respect to the first drink as that of an individual with a passion, say, for jaywalking. Now, I don't understand this guy at all. Now, I can see him out here on the interstate. I can see him waiting for a big bus to come along. Jump out in front of that bus, spin around two or three times, see how close he can come to hitting him without actually hitting him. For some reason, he gets a thrill out of that. I don't understand it, but I can see him doing it. He enjoys himself for a few years in spite of friendly warnings. Now, up to this point, you would label him as a foolish chap having queer ideas of fun. Luck then deserts him, and he's slightly injured several times in succession. He's getting a little older now. He can't move as fast. They begin to hit him once in a while. Nothing serious. He just kind of bounces off of him. Now, you would expect him, if he were normal, to cut it out. But presently, he's hit again. This time, has a fractured skull. He got hurt pretty bad this time. Within a week after leaving the hospital, a fast-moving trolley car breaks his arm. Now, he does the same thing that Bill Wilson did. He says, he tells you he's decided to stop jaywalking for good. He said, by God, that's it. I'll never jaywalk again as long as I live. I'll use my willpower and I'll be okay. But in a few weeks, he breaks both legs. Now, on through the years, this conduct continues accompanied by his continual promises to be careful or to keep off the streets altogether. Finally, he can no longer work. He just so beat up now, he can't get a job. His wife gets a divorce. She's tired of supporting him, the kids, and everybody else, and he's held up to ridicule. He tries every known means to get the jaywalking idea out of his head. Not his body, his head. He shuts himself up in a treatment center hoping to mend his ways. They got him for everything else, surely they do for jaywalking. Don't mind us kidding about treatment centers. Joe runs one, and I've been involved in them for years, and I think they're a good thing, but we love to make jokes about them. He shuts himself in an asylum hoping to mend his ways. But the day he comes out, he races in front of a fire engine which breaks his back. Such a man would be crazy, wouldn't he? Now, you may think our illustration is too ridiculous, but is it? We who have been through the ringer have to admit if we substituted alcoholism for jaywalking, the illustration would fit us exactly. However intelligent we may have been in other respects, where alcohol has been involved, we've been strangely insane. Strong language, but isn't it true? Oh, I think that's so appropriate today. You know, again, because of education, many, many people are coming to us before they have to lose everything. And once in a while, we see somebody come in AA today who's still got a job. Sometimes they're still married. I even know one or two that came in here and still owned an automobile when they got here. And we talk to those people about insanity, and they say, well, how in the hell can I be insane? Look what I've got. I've got a job. I've got a wife. I've got a car. We're not talking about those things. We're talking about one thing and one thing only, our attitude toward alcohol itself. And it seems as though when it comes to alcohol, we are strangely insane. Now, years later, I realize that I'm not too swift in a hell of a lot of areas. But in the beginning, I'm looking at alcohol only. What's my attitude toward it? Now, some of you are thinking, yes, what you tell us is true, but it doesn't fully apply. We admit we have some of these symptoms, but we've not gone to the extremes you fellows did, nor are we likely to, for we understand ourselves so well after what you told us that such things cannot happen again. We've not lost everything in life through drinking, and we certainly do not intend to. Thanks for the information. I remember the day I told them that, too. Now, that may be true of certain non-alcoholic people who, though drinking foolishly and heavily at the present time, are able to stop or moderate because their brains and bodies have not been damaged as ours were. We've already talked about that heavy drinker. But the actual or potential alcoholic, with hardly an exception, will be absolutely unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. This is a point we wish to emphasize and re-emphasize to smash home upon our alcoholic readers as has been revealed to us at a bitter experience. Let us take another illustration. The old Jim, when he got drunk, remember, he had lost everything. Old Jim, when he got drunk, he didn't feel too good. And he ended up taking a drink based on that basis. Now, we're going to look at Fred. Fred has never lost anything. And the day Fred gets drunk, he's feeling great, floating along, and everything is fine. You know, it seems as though we alcoholics, when we feel bad, we drink to feel better, but when we feel good, we drink to feel better yet. And Jim, or Fred, ends up getting drunk just exactly like Jim did. He believes something that isn't true. Joe?
Okay. Fred is a part in a well-known accounting firm. His income is good. He has a fine home. He's happy married and father of promising children of college age. His so attractive personality, it makes Fred with it, friends with everyone. Wherever there's a successful businessman, it is Fred. Now, Fred is doing good with his business. Number Jim lost his. To all appearances, a stable, well-balanced individual, yet he is alcoholic. I first saw Fred about a year ago in a hospital where he had gone to recover from a bad case of jitters. It was the first experience of this kind. He was much ashamed of it, far from admitting he was an alcoholic. Remember, Jim admitted that, but Fred wouldn't. He told himself he came to the hospital to rest his nerves.
We see lots of nerve resters in our day. Just like Fred.
Nervous people. That nervous breakdown.
Yeah.
Dr. Emblady strongly did it might be worse than he realized. For a few days he was oppressed about his condition. He made up his mind to quit drinking altogether. It never occurred to him perhaps he could not do so in spite of his character and standing. Fred would not believe himself as an alcoholic. He would not take step one, much less accept a spiritual remedy for his problem. Therefore he wouldn't accept step two. We told him what we knew about alcoholism. They tried to give Fred step one. He was interested and conceded he had some of the symptoms. You know, he said, I'm a little bit alcoholic, maybe. Well, he was a long way from admitting he could do nothing about it. He admitted he was powerless. He wouldn't take it completely, so he couldn't do nothing. It was a positive that humiliating experience plus the knowledge he acquired would keep him sober for the rest of his life. Self-knowledge would fix it. Now, we heard no more from Fred for a while, and one day we were told he was back in the hospital. Here he is again. This time, he was quite shaky. He soon indicated he was anxious to see us. The story he told is quite instructive, for here was a chap, after he was convinced he had to stop drinking, who had no excuse for drinking, who exhibited splendid judgment and determination in all other concerns, yet was flat on his back. In all other areas, this man could run his life, but not in this area. So let him tell you about it. And this is how it happened. He said, I was much impressed with what you fellows said about alcoholism, and I frankly did not believe it would be possible for me to drink again. I rather appreciated your ideas about the subtle insanity which precedes the first drink, but I was confident it could not happen to me after what I had learned. I reasoned I was not so far advanced as most of you fellas, and that I was usually successful in licking my other personal problems, and that I would therefore be successful where you men failed. I felt I had every right to be self-confident. It was the only matter of exercising my willpower and keeping on going. You know, I'm not as bad as y'all, and I got a lot of willpower. In this frame of mind, I went about my business. for a time all was well. I had no trouble refusing drink.
Now, you know, Fred is, we could compare Fred and Jim, you know, back and forth. Now, Jim lost his business, and Jim, you know, was working for somebody else, and everything was going pretty bad for Jim. But Fred is on another, Fred is a partner in a well-known accounting firm. His income is good. He has a fine home, is happy married, the father of promising children of college age. He is so attractive a personality that he makes fair with everyone. If there was a successful businessman, it's Fred. So Fred is doing good. So it appears that he's stable, well-balanced individual. Yet he is alcoholic. We first saw Fred about a year ago in a hospital where he had gone to recover from a bad case of jitters. It was his first experience of this kind. He had, you know, this was his first time, and he was much ashamed of it. Far from he's admitting he was an alcoholic, he told himself he'd come from the hospital to rest his nerves. And again, as comparing it with Jim, remember, Jim took 3 steps. Now look what Fred did. The doctor emulated strongly that he might be worse than he realized. For a few days, he was depressed about his condition. He made up his mind to quit drinking altogether. He never occurred to him, perhaps, he could not do so in spite of his character and standing. Fred would not believe himself an alcoholic. He wouldn't take step one. Nor less accept spiritual remedy for his problem. He wouldn't accept step two. We told him what we knew of alcoholism. They told him about step one. He was interested to see some of the symptoms. Okay, now, after they talked to Fred and he wouldn't accept this, and he went on, and then he got drunk again, and he went back in the hospital and he wanted to see them again, and he went back in, and they asked him how he got drunk. And he explains this beginning at the bottom of the page. He said, in this frame of mind, I went about my business for a time and all was well. I had no trouble refusing drinks and began to wonder if I had not been making too hard a work out of a simple matter. And he got out of the hospital and he said, you know, this ain't no deal. I just quit it and I don't know. It'll make no big deal out of this. Anybody can do this. And he said his business was going good and everything. And he said, one day I went to Washington to present some accounting evidence to a government bureau. He had to make a trip. I had been out of town before doing this particular dry spell, so there was nothing new about that. You know, he'd been traveling before. Physically, I felt fine. Neither did I have any pressing problems or worries. And remember, Jim, when Jim got drunk, he had a lot of bosses picking on him and everything was going on. Now, this guy said, my business came off well on this trip. I was pleased and knew my partners would be, too. It was the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. And I love this guy, the way this guy builds up to his drunk. You know what I mean? He said, I went to the hotel and leisurely dressed for dinner. As I crossed the threshold of the dining room, the thought came to mind it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails with dinner. That's all, nothing more. And I laugh every time I get to this. You know, this guy goes to Washington, presents his evidence, talks to these government people. Boy, and this comes off great. It seemed like he might have some apprehension, but the thing come off good. He said, I was pleased and knew my partners would be too. Then he said, it was the end of a perfect day. How many of these do we have? Not a cloud on the horizon. This guy said he went to, you know, he has this great day. And he walks into the dining room of his hotel and said, oh, what a beautiful day. One of the greatest days of my life. I believe I'll have a drink and go back to the hospital. Now that, that is insanity. You know, when we're like, that's what he did. That is insanity.
You see, that's the truth.
That's the truth.
That's insanity. Now, he couldn't drink on the truth. So he had to say, a couple of cocktails before dinner would be nice.
Right.
That was all.
Right.
Nothing more.
Right.
Now, that's when he became insane.
Mm-hmm.
Now, based on the insane idea, he made a decision. He said, I ordered a cocktail in my meal. Then I ordered another cocktail. Now we've got it in our system, and we've triggered the allergy now. After dinner, I decided to take a walk. When I returned to the hotel, it struck me a highball would be fine before going to bed, so I stepped into the bar and had one. I remember having several more that night and pretty next morning. Boy, you can't stop now. I have a shadowy recollection of being in an airplane bound for New York and of finding a friendly taxicab driver at the landing field instead of my wife, and the driver escorted me about for several days. I know little of where I went or what I said and did. Then came the hospital with unbearable mental and physical suffering. As soon as I regained my ability to think, I went carefully over that evening in Washington. Not only had I been off guard, I had made no fight whatever against the first drink. This time I had not thought of the consequences at all. I had commenced to drink as carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. Now, is this guy's problem the fact that he can't drink? Or is his problem the fact that he thinks he can drink? You see, just before he took the first drink, he's stone cold sober. And he believes something that is not true. He believed a couple of cocktails before dinner would be nice. Yeah, they would be all right. But if we could just look that thing all the way through and see what's going to happen to us, then we could not take that drink at all. We can't drink on the tree. It says on the bottom of page 43, once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink, except in a few rare cases. Neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. That's why willpower don't work. You see, in order for willpower to work, the mind's got to see something wrong with what it's wanting to do. But just before you and I drink, our mind doesn't see anything wrong with drinking. And if our mind doesn't see anything wrong with drinking, then willpower is non-existent. At certain times, we have no willpower when it comes to alcohol. Our defense will have to come from a power greater than human power. Now, he has convinced me in this chapter. He convinced me if I don't find this spiritual experience, I'm probably going to die from my disease. Joe?
He said, let's go eat.
Let's go have some lunch, and we'll start back about 1:30.
Yeah.
We'll probably run till about 4:30 or 5 this afternoon. We'll be doing chapter 4. Then we'll go into chapter 5, and we'll try to do steps 3 and 4 this afternoon. And we want to show you this afternoon how to work step 4 right out of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. We believe we found the instructions to tell us exactly how to do step 4, and we'll find it's a very simple thing done the way the big book says to do it. So we hope to see you about 1:30. Thank you for being here this morning. Everybody's ready with it. Up until now, we've looked at the problem and the doctor's opinion and Bill's story. We've looked at the solution in chapter 2, and we've looked at the real need for that solution in chapter 3, more about alcoholism, where we discuss the obsession of the mind, the idea that we can drink, overcoming the idea that we cannot, making us believe something that isn't true, making us believe that it's okay to drink when it's obvious it isn't. And we see that as a form of insanity, the inability to see the truth about alcohol. And I think in this chapter 3, he has now firmly, completely convinced me that if I don't have that vital spiritual experience, that I'm probably not going to recover from the disease of alcoholism. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that I like the idea at all, because I still have some of the old ideas concerning spirituality and God that I learned as a kid growing up. Still don't necessarily like the idea of being so weak that I'm going to have to turn to something else for help. Still remember that for years I looked on the people who believed in God as a bunch of hypocrites. Every once in a while, I'd go in the bar, and I could see Deacon Brown in there.
And sometimes Deacon Brown had Brother Jones' wife with him. And I'd say, yeah, that's just like them. They're all the same damn way. So a lot of aversion to this spiritual thing. And many of us are that way. And I think probably in order for me to go ahead with this spiritual experience, that I'm going to absolutely have to be able to change my beliefs and some of my ideas about this God as I understand him. Remember, I was raised in the good old Southern Baptist Church. And you go to hell there for lying and cheating and stealing and drinking and all those things. And I just knew that God wouldn't have anything to do with me because of what I'd been in my past. I knew that there would be no chance of me ever having a vital spiritual experience based upon the old understanding of God. And today I thank AA basically for two things. Number one was the first idea of God as I understand him. But what I really thank AA for is a new understanding of God. And I think Bill was so much like the rest of us that he realized that even faced with this thing at the end of chapter 3, that many of us still could not go any further with this thing without new information of some kind. And he wrote a chapter called We Agnostics. And in We Agnostics, I think he gives us kind of a spiritual kindergarten. I think he gives us a way to change our old ideas about God and a way to develop a new concept or a new God of our understanding. And based upon what I learned in chapter 4, I can go ahead and make a decision I'm going to be called upon to make in just a little while. But on the old understanding, I never could have made a decision. So I think for we alcoholics, one of the most important parts of this book will be this chapter, chapter 4, We Agnostics. Because so many of us felt the same way, and so many of us had so much difficulty with this thing called God, and especially God as we understood him. I never could have come to terms with that old God of my understanding, Joe.
Okay. We agnostics. In the preceding chapter, you have learned something of alcoholism. Surely we have already. Well, we'll make clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. They have dealt with this. If when as you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. And he gives us two questions to determine whether you're alcoholic. Now, this was very simple to determine if you were alcoholic. There's two questions. If when you honestly want, you cannot quit entirely, that's one. Or when drinking, you have little controlled amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. And I can answer that really specifically and see if I was an alcoholic. I could never quit entirely. And I had little control over the amount I take, so I was alcoholic. Now, this was a big book, and it has been it's unchanged. This is the way it was written in 1939. And in 1939, the first 100 people, they had two questions to determine if you were alcoholic. But later on, we wrote a pamphlet with 44 questions. See how we improve on things, don't you? It don't take but two. You know, just two questions.
I thank God today that Eddie didn't have the 44 questions when he talked to Bill in his kitchen. Old Bill sitting there drunk, been drinking for 3 or 4 weeks, all hung over. Had that bowl of bathtub gin and pineapple juice mixed up in front of him. His wife was supporting him at $25 a week. Abby would have said, Bill, has your reputation been suffering from your drinking? Hell, he hadn't had a reputation in years. And then he'd have said, has your sex life been interfered with by your drinking? And he hadn't had any of that in years either. Two simple questions. And when I read those, I just asked them to me. I said, Charlie, have you been able to quit entirely when you wanted to quit? I had to say, no, I can't do that. And I said, Charlie, do you have little control over the amount you take? And I said, I've never had any control over the amount I take once I start drinking. So that means I'm probably alcoholic. Now, if that be the case, then you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. And again, he comes right back at us again.
That's right.
With this idea that the spiritual experience is necessary for recovery. To one who feels he's an atheist or agnostic, such an experience seems impossible. And it sure seemed that way to me. But to continue as he is means disaster, especially if he's an alcoholic of a hopeless variety. To be doomed to an alcoholic death.
Step one.
Or to live on a spiritual basis.
Step two.
Are not always easy alternatives to face. And he repeats himself again with this same theme over and over. Steps one and two. But it isn't so difficult. About half our original fellowship were of exactly that type. At first, some of us tried to avoid the issue, hoping against hope we were not true alcoholics. But after a while, we had to face the fact that we must find a spiritual basis of life or else. Perhaps it's going to be that way with you. But cheer up. Something like half of us thought we were atheists or agnostics, and our experience shows that you need not be disconcerted. And I found that when I got to this part of the book, I really didn't know what I was. I didn't know whether I was atheist, whether I was agnostic, or just how I really did feel about this God thing. So I again had to do a little searching for information. I had to find out, well, what is an atheist anyhow? And I find that an atheist is one who says that God does not exist.
Sure.
Now, if you're a human being and you really believe that God does not exist, then you don't have any place to turn to for help. Because you can't trust other people. And if God isn't there, then you've got to run your own show. You have nobody to turn to. You got to make your own decisions, stand on your own two feet, rule your own destiny, because there's no God to turn to. And I said, well, Charlie, are you an atheist? And I said, no, I'm not an atheist. I've always believed in some form of a God. So I said, well, maybe then you're agnostic. So I had to find out what an agnostic is. And I found out an agnostic is one who believes in God, but acts as if he doesn't. Acts just exactly like the atheist. Stands on his own two feet. Runs his own show. Makes his own decisions. And rules his own destiny. Even though he believes in God, he doesn't turn to God for help. And he runs the show himself. And he gets exactly the same thing the atheist gets, which is zero. Even though he believes that God exists. And I said, are you an agnostic? And I said, you betcha. That's what I've been all my life. I've always believed in God. I don't know whether I was born with it or whether I was taught with that belief, but I've always believed that God existed in some form or other, but I've always acted as if he didn't exist. So the question in my mind today is, if I'm atheist or agnostic, then how can I be one who can turn to God and get help from him? Well, that's what this chapter is for. To show me how to get from being an atheist or an agnostic to one who is a true believer. Because you see, a true believer is one who believes in God and acts as if he does. Doesn't try to stand on his own two feet, run his own show, and rule his own destiny. He turns to God for help. Gets that help in his life, and then he no longer believes that God exists, he knows that he does. And there's only three ways you can believe in God. You can be an atheist, an agnostic, or a true believer. So if you are an atheist or an agnostic, the question becomes, how do I get to be a true believer? How do I get to be one who can use that power and know that God exists? And this chapter is going to show me exactly how. It said if a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. And I believe that to be true. We're not bums. We're not drunken bums. A drunken bum is one who's just about where he wants to be, doing what he wants to do, and not too interested in changing the situation. But an alcoholic is different. I've never seen an alcoholic yet that didn't have a code of morals. I've never seen an alcoholic yet that didn't have a good philosophy of life. We all know that we're supposed to work, take care of our families, do the things necessary to be successful in our community. We've all had that good philosophy, and we've all had a set of morals, but we never could live up to them because of our alcoholism. Now, if the morals and philosophy would have saved us, many of us would have recovered long ago. But we found that such codes and philosophies did not save us, no matter how much we tried. We could wish to be moral. We could wish to be philosophically comforted. In fact, we could will these things with all our might. But the needed power wasn't there. Our human resources, as marshaled by the will, were not sufficient. They failed utterly. Lack of power, that was our dilemma. And today I believe that 100%. If you and I could have found the power to solve our problem, we never would have come to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't really believe that any of us were here in the beginning because we wanted to be. I think we were driven here under the lash of alcoholism because we couldn't find enough power to solve the problem in any other way. This was the court of last resort. I've never seen a person who started drinking at age 14, jumped up and down and shouted with joy and said, I can hardly wait until I'm 36 and I get to be a member of AA. If we could have found the answer any other way, we sure would have used it rather than come to Alcoholics Anonymous. So lack of power was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how were we to find that power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. That doesn't say it's to help you solve your problem, or to enable you to solve your problem. It says the main object is to find the power greater than ourselves, which will solve the problem. Now, up until this page of the book, I've been looking at sobriety, 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 not drinking is the answer. And my book said that really isn't true. Yet the main purpose of this book is to find the power. And I think, interestingly enough, from page 45 on, we don't talk about alcohol anymore. The rest of this book will be devoted to one subject and one subject only. How do you find that power? And if you find that power, then that power will solve the alcoholism problem for you, if you find the power. Joe?
Okay, now, it gives us a simple procedure. As we look throughout this, as Charlie said, this is like a spiritual king going out. Heard a guy talking about this not so long ago, and we see that it's a different approach. As most people try to get us to accept spiritual things in a different way, they try to sell us on the idea. And this is a different approach. It doesn't try to sell you God. It doesn't try to prove God to you. But it has a simple procedure if taken that would allow God to prove himself to you. If you feel this, if you follow this procedure, God will find you. You won't have to find God. That's another backdoor thing, is the way they do it here. So we begin to, on page 47 of the book, in this simple procedure. So we needed to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, this is it, or am I willing to believe that there is a power greater than myself. As soon as a man can say he does believe or is willing to believe, we emphatically show him that he is on his way. It has been repeatedly proven among us that upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderful, effective spiritual structure can be built. Now, as Charlie says, the atheist does not believe in God. And that the agnostic believes in God, but he doesn't know, but he believes in God. Now, how do we begin to develop a spiritual life for these two people? Now, it's obvious if you don't believe, that if you're an atheist and don't believe, in order to have a spiritual life, you would have to come to believe. Now, if you're an agnostic and you believe already, then it's just opening your eyes. You already believe, then you can get started. Come on. You can get started right from where you at. All you got to do, you already believe. You're at a starting point. So if you don't believe, you have to come to believe. If you believe already, then you can start right there. In fact, that's the only where you can start. You can't start on faith. Believing is the state of the mind, a state of the individual before you do something. You know, for many years, I had a lot of problems with words and concepts, and I had religion mixed up, and I was so confused about these terms. But before you do something, you believe you can do it. Now, once you believe you can do it, then the next part of the procedure, the one procedure to do anything, and once you believe, it's a state of the mind, a force, a power that we have that gets us started. Now, believing to become effective is like a domino theory. It produces decision. You believe something, and then you make a decision based on what you believe. So believing has to bring on decision. Now, decision doesn't produce a lot of results, because the decision, like a domino theory again, the precision will trigger actions. We will act out the decision. Now, it's from the actions we take that we get results. We get results from the actions. And once we get good results from the actions we take, then we know, which is faith. Now, I use that same principle. There's a man across the street there's a mechanic, and Charlie gets some work done over there. He comes back and tells me, that guy does good mechanical work over there. The only thing I can do with that is I can believe it or disbelieve it. Now, if I believe it, I'm ready to get started. Somewhere along the line, I make a decision to carry my car over there. And then I take the actions. I carry my car over there, and the guy does some work on it. I go over and get it. When I get my car, the guy done a great job. The car runs fine. As soon as I get in the car and drive it around the block a couple of times, immediately my belief, I quit believing in that guy, and I got faith all at once. Now I got faith in him. Feel me? A whole lot of difference between when I went over there and when I drove around the block a couple of times. Feel me? Now, the next time I go back over there to get some work done, I go back on faith. But the first time, the beginning is to believe. So all we have to do here is to believe. We don't have to have faith. We don't have to have trust. All we got to do is to believe, and it's easy to believe. If you come to AA and look around all the other people that are sober, how can we not believe? Or how can we not come to believe? So believing is the beginning, and that's all we have to do in this particular program to develop our spiritual lives. He said, that was great news for us. Here's some of the first 100 talking. For we had assumed, I did too, this is what I was doing. I had always assumed that in order to make use of spiritual principles,
unless we accepted many things on faith. I thought, too, that you had to have faith, which seemed difficult to believe. You don't have to have faith. In fact, you cannot have faith. You can only believe. And believing is the beginning of everything that we do. It's our believing and how we use this force that we have and how we apply it in our lives. You know, our success in life is based on that, too. Our failure and success is based on what we believe, and it's how we use this force in our lives and how we apply it on a daily basis. Our lives are not based on our talent. No, we have great talent. Our talent is no better than what we believe we have. That's the limitation of our talent. It's what we believe.
This was the first old idea to be cast aside. You see, my minister always said, son, if you'll just have faith, everything will be all right. And I didn't have any faith that God would do for me what I could not do for myself. In fact, I assumed that God had already condemned me to hell. And I couldn't have faith because I was just barely able to believe. And my book says, you don't have to have faith. All you got to have to begin with is belief. And I've always believed that God existed. If I didn't believe it, then why was I so worried about him sending me to hell if I didn't believe it? If I didn't believe it, who was it I talked to when I laid in jail and said, God, get me out of this damn mess and I swear I'll never do it again. Now, the agnostic already believes. The atheist can become willing to believe. So it opens the door for any of us to make our beginning. You'll notice also, he said, it has been repeatedly proven among us that upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. This is the second reference to a structure that we're in the process of building. Willingness was the foundation. Now then, believing becomes the cornerstone of this structure. And then he has an asterisk there, and we go to the bottom of the page, and it says, please be sure to read Appendix 2 on spiritual experience. Just literally begging us to understand what he's talking about. Now, apparently, the wonderfully effective spiritual structure, with it keyed to the asterisk, and the asterisk keying us to the spiritual experience, the spiritual structure and the spiritual experience are the same thing. And that is a personality change sufficient to recover from the disease of alcoholism. So we're already in the process of putting it together. We've laid the foundation, we've set in the cornerstone, and we're on our way to recovery if we believe or if we are willing to believe. Now, let's go look at an example or two of what could be done based upon belief on page 51.
Okay. He says, this world as ours has made more material progress in the last century than all the millenniums which went before. Yeah, we have made more material progress in the last 100 years than all the men on the face of this earth, all the time. And almost everyone knows the reason, and I don't think we really have stopped long enough to look at that. And we don't realize that. I always thought that, you know, in the last 100 years, that we are so smart. You know, we are intelligent. I realize that the people lived about 1,000 years ago at that time thought that they were intelligent, too. But I realize, you know, that I thought that we were smart and those people back in those days were dumb or ignorant. But it says here, students of ancient history tell us that the intellect of the men in those days was equal to the best of the day. You know, the men of the past in those days, they had just the same intelligence, the same knowledge that we have today. It says, yet in ancient times, material progress was painfully slow. We can look at all the things we have today. We can look at the airplanes and automobiles, and microwave ovens, forms of energy, and televisions and everything that we have, most of all of it has been, all of it we use today has been developed in the last 100 years. So, other people, they didn't do any of this. They didn't, they had the same minds that we have, the same intelligence, yet they didn't invent anything. So the spirit of modern scientific inquiry and research and invention was almost unknown. They didn't invent hardly anything. And here's why. In the realm of material, men's minds were fettered by superstition and tradition and all sort of fixed ideas. You know, and people of ancient time didn't invent anything because they did not believe. They did not use their power of believing that they could do anything. In fact, the society in itself did not allow people to believe differently. You know, in those days, they were superstitious, and they would suspect you if you would start talking about something new in those days. In fact, they might take you out and cut your head off. Can you imagine some guy, he'd be out, and they see him over there in his workshop working, and they say, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm going to make a television." They said, "What's that?" He said, they'd kill him if they caught him trying to make something like that. You know, they forced you not to believe, just that and nothing different. Therefore, all the talent was wasted because people were not allowed to believe and to invent, so they didn't discover anything new. And here are some great examples. Some of the contemporaries of Columbus thought a round earth preposterous, and this was true. You know, at the time, you know, and sometimes everybody believed a lie at that time. At Columbus' time, everybody believed a lie. They didn't know it, but even yet in our days and times, we believe lies right now. We believe lies. In Columbus' days, they believed lies. They believed the world was flat, and that was a lie, but they didn't know that. Because, you know, in those days, some of the ships had probably sailed out into the ocean. Most of the civilization was around the Mediterranean and that part of the country, and the world, and the total world was around in Europe and that part of the country. And as they got in their ships and went out to sea, some of them probably got lost. They didn't have the navigation equipment that they needed, and they got too far out and they got lost and didn't come back. Well, obviously, somebody assumed. You know, probably alcoholic. If the ships went out and they didn't come back, we assume they went off the edge, right? That was an assumption, right? It was wrong. They might have, I don't know what happened to them, but they didn't go off the edge. So since they went off the edge, the world is flat. And it became accepted if you go so far out there, you fall off. And that was a lie, and everybody believed that. And then Columbus come along, and then he was able to change it. Now, Columbus changed. I love this story of Columbus, and actually what this man did. He changed the whole world. He changed the maps of the world. He changed the shape of countries. He changed the economics of the world. He created all the empires of the world with his ideas. It affected his life. It affects his life of probably everybody on the face of the earth. Everybody that faced this earth since then has been affected by what Columbus did. One man. Columbus changed the total world on one basic little concept. You know, whatever we believe, we become. And that's the principle. Whatever we believe today, we will finally become that. Now, so if you want to change, and this is what Columbus wanted to do, you have to believe different. You can't believe the same and remain the same. If you believe the same, you remain the same. But that change you got, if you believe different, you will become something different. So Columbus was big enough to believe different against all those other people that were there on the earth at that time. See, all the other people say it was flat, and Columbus said, "I believe it's round." Now, Columbus was, John and I talk about it, but it's obvious this man was an alcoholic, you know. Now, who else could believe against the world? Everybody in the world said it was flat. And this guy was a hard-headed, self-willed alcoholic. He was the only man to say, I believe it's round. You know, but they say he's crazy. You know, we tell the story all the time. We know he was. There's some other things that say he's alcoholic because he, not only did he believe different, but when he left, he didn't know where he was going. You know, that's a drunk. And when he got there, he didn't know where he was. And when he got back, he didn't know where he had been. But what really makes him an alcoholic was a woman financed the whole trip. And this guy did die in jail. You know, he died in jail. But he was big enough to believe different. And this is the way he started. He believed the world was round. This was the beginning of the great change he made. And he made a decision, he took the action, and he made the trip. And when he come back, the whole world changed what they believed. He changed the whole world with this simple principle. And I think it's a great, that's why the book uses it, for us to examine the use of this in our lives. Now, Charlie and I always, we always thinking about Columbus. I think AA ought to adopt Columbus Day. That's our day, you know. But we think Columbus, he got all these ships together and hired the crews, put them on the ships that night, and they set out. He hired one special sailor on the lead ship. That was the ship he's on. He put him up in the conning tower every night.
Right in the front of the boat.
Right in front of the boat. Oh, in the front. Yeah, right, so he could see good. And he told him, he said, he had a lantern too. And he said, I believe the world is round. But he said, if you see the edge of this damn thing, you holler out.
Yeah. You see? There's a hell of a big difference between belief and faith. Now let's see what Columbus really did. Now Columbus followed a formula.
That's right.
Which the human race has always used for success. The human race has always used it to change. The first thing in order to change, you've got to believe you can change. That's the first thing you can possibly do. Now, Columbus stood on the shore of the ocean when he said, I believe the world is round. But that really didn't do him any good. Because several months later, he was standing on the edge of the ocean saying, I believe the world is round. The second thing you got to do to change is to make a decision about it. And Columbus said, by golly, I'm going to go find out whether it's round or not. He made a decision. But that didn't do him a hell of a lot good either. Because a year or two later, he's still standing on the shore of the ocean believing that the world is round and deciding to do something about it. If you want to carry out your decision, you then have to take action. Now, the action that he took, he began to look for money. And he went to the King of Portugal. And the King of Portugal, being a level-headed businessman, said, Columbus, there's no way I'm going to let you have this money. He said, you will sail right out there, and you'll sail out the edge of this damn thing, and I'll lose it all. He said, I don't care what you believe. I know that the world's flat. That's when he ended up with the Queen of Spain. That's when he sweet-talked her out of the money by giving her some promises and stuff. She let him have the money. He bought the ships. He provisioned the ships. He hired the crews. And then they began to sail across the ocean. All kinds of action taking place. Now, as the result of the action, they finally got over on the other side of the ocean and they found land. After the action was taken, he got results. And the results would be the finding of the land on the other side of the ocean. Then he came back home and he went right back to the Queen of Spain. And she said, Columbus, where's the gold and the silk and the spices that you promised me you would bring me? He said, honey, I didn't find any of them at all. If you'll finance me again, I'll go back, and this time I'll find them. And she let him have the money, and he went back the second time. Now, the difference is that when he went back the second time, he didn't have to go on belief at all. He now went back on faith, because now he knew that the world was round, and he knew you would not sail off the edge of it, and he didn't hire the special sailor and put him on the front of the lead ship with a lantern at night, because he knew he wouldn't sail off the edge of it. A long distance from belief to faith. Now, our program in Alcoholics Anonymous is set up by exactly the same formula. You know, we like to think in AA that this is something that we invented, but it really isn't. We come to believe in step two. And then we make a decision in step three. And then we take action in steps four through nine. And then we get results in the promises. And then we will experience step 12, and we will know, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. So we're using the simple little formula that Columbus used also, by believing, deciding, acting, and getting results, and then we will know. So we're going to follow the same identical procedure, and we're going to do the same thing Columbus did. We're going to start first with belief. And the only thing that can hold you and I back and stop us is if we are not willing to believe. Or if we disbelieve and we're unwilling to change our disbelief, that's the only thing in the world that can stop us. Now, my book also shows me an example of how truth may not even always be right. You know, so many of we atheists, we sit around and we waited to have proof of something before we would act. Now, we thought God existed, but we would like to really know that before we make any decisions, just in case he didn't exist. And we wanted somebody to prove to us before we would make that venture. And proof's not always right either. It shows me on page 51 at the bottom of the page an example where proof itself was wrong. Said we ask ourselves this, are not some of us just as biased and unreasonable about the realm of the spirit as were the ancients about the realm of the material? Even the present century American newspapers were afraid to print an account of the Wright brothers' first successful flight at Kitty Hawk. Had not all efforts at flight failed before? Did not Professor Langley's flying machine go to the bottom of the Potomac River? Was it not true that the best mathematical minds had proved man could never fly? Had not people said God had reserved this privilege to the birds? You know, back in this century, the one we're living in right now, it had been proven by the best mathematical minds in the world that you could not build a powered aircraft that would support its own weight and the weight of a person flying it. An absolute impossibility. Everybody that had tried it had failed before. Now here comes the two Wright brothers. Now these guys are not mathematical geniuses. They're not aeronautical engineers. They are both high school dropouts. And they are bicycle mechanics. Now, how in the hell a bicycle mechanic believes he can build an airplane is beyond me. But they believe they could. Now, based upon their belief, they made a decision. They cleaned the bicycle shop out. And they brought in some materials. And they sat down and drew up a set of blueprints. And they began to build this airplane, taking action. And one day they built this thing, they took it out to Kitty Hawk to fly it, and they tried to fly it, and it crashed. And I could just see Orville turn to Wilbur and say, "And you, Wilbur, I told you this damn thing wouldn't work, you know." But Wilbur said, "Let's take it back to the shop, modify it, repair it, and try again." And after some failures, they took it out there one day, and that damn thing flew. It not only flew, but it supported the weight of one of those two guys. And somebody ran to the phone and called this American newspaper man and said, quick, quick, put it out over the wires of the world that the Wright brothers have flown a powered aircraft at Kitty Hawk. And the newspaper man said, you crazy as hell. He said, if I do that, they'll fire me for telling that kind of lie. Mankind had proved that you could not do this. So proof is not always right either. These two guys disproved the proof by first beginning to believe.
That's right.
Today, right now, in 1987, the best mathematical minds in the world can prove to you today beyond any shadow of a doubt that a bumblebee cannot fly.
Sure.
He's got a little short, fat, stubby body. He got a little short, stubby wings. Mathematically, it's impossible for him to generate enough lift to pick himself up off the ground. Now, the only thing wrong with that theory is that the bumblebee can't read. He believes he can fly. And based upon his belief, he makes decisions and takes action, and he just flies all over the world. He'd be in a hell of a shape if they ever teach him how to read. So those of us that have been waiting on proof, then proof's not always right either. So we see what can result just from believing. And that's all we've got to do is just believe in order to start. Now, the book has told me two things. First, it has told me that I've got to find a power greater than human power. And second, it's told me that the only thing I've got to do to start the finding of that power is to believe that I can. And the third thing it's going to tell me to solve this whole puzzle is where to find that power. If I know I've got to have it, and I know that I start with belief, then if I just know where that power is, then chances are I'm going to be able to find it. And all my life, I've looked for God. You know, I've looked for Him in the sky. I always thought that He was a tall, elderly gentleman standing on a cloud, long, flowing white robes, golden halo around His head, sun rays shooting out of it. I really don't know where I got that idea, but I picked it up somewhere. One reason I thought He dwelt in the sky is because every time the preacher talked about Him, He looked up there. He sat up there and He looked up there. And what really confused me is every time He talked to Him, He would bow His head and look down there. And He had me damn well confused where God is. Everybody says you got to find God, you got to find... We don't think you got to find God because we don't think God's lost. If you've been here since the beginning of time, it's pretty difficult to get lost. We think the reason we've never been able to find God is simply because we never knew where God was. And it took the big book Alcoholics Anonymous to tell me where He is. On page 55, it'll tell me where I'm going to be able to find Him. It said, yet we'd been seeing another kind of flight, a spiritual liberation from this world, people who rose above their problems. They said God made these things possible, and we only smiled. We had seen spiritual release, but not to tell ourselves it wasn't true. Actually, we were fooling ourselves. For deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calumny, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form or other it is there. For faith in a power greater than ourselves, and miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself.